Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep. All right, Bobby. Would you like to do it?
Yeah, go ahead and start me, and I'll just take it. Through.
Okay, 3, 2, 1. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab,
and today I brought us a little story.
Hello,
Lucy. That is
Robert.
Oh, great. Okay, well, a sort of slippery mystery.
Slippery mystery. Okay,
yes. And the mystery comes from this woman. Lucy Cook.
I'm the author of The Truth About Animals.
And it's filled with strange stories. Yes, it's really like we're like feasting on this book. Okay. So Lucy wrote a book, and the book is actually a collection of animal profiles which come from her journalism. And I love it a lot. And so I called her up and we just started talking about
frogs.
All sorts of animals.
Bats.
Sloths.
The island of dwarf stone sloths in Panama.
I have no idea what that means. We talked about birds. Birds are like turtles?
No.
We talked about
if you're a female panda.
Bears.
What you're really looking for in a male panda is one that can squirt his pee quite high up a tree.
But what I really wanted to talk to Lucy about? Well, I'm going to stop right there and switch quickly to eels. Because we only have 33 minutes left, and I don't want to...
Oh my God, the eel's so good.
And the eels are so good. Because as you will soon learn, the story of the eel is really, and this is strange to think about, the limits of human knowledge.
Yeah, are you ready to rock and roll?
You could just start with, like, tell me when you first encountered this creature.
Oh, I was a very geeky only child. And what I loved to do more than anything else in the world was, my father sunk an old Victorian bath into the garden, and that became my Narnia. And I sort of disappear into this watery kingdom and, you know, was obsessed with creating the perfect pond ecosystem out of this rather sterile tub for human ablution. It became my... It was everything to me. So every Sunday I'd nag my dad, can we go to the ditches of Romney Marsh, please, Dad? And he'd sort of take me off and we'd go. He made me a net to catch things with out of a pair of old net curtains that I'd sort of trawl through the ditches of Romney Marsh and catch all these wonderful creatures, you know, pond skaters and newts and frogs, and I'd bring them back to my tub. But eels became my holy grail, because the thing about eels, I don't know, Robert, have you ever tried to catch one?
No, I would never even think to try to catch one because they're ooky and slimy and they remind me of snakes.
Yeah, no, I wanted to because I wanted to have all animals, much like Noah. I wanted all animals to be represented in my pond. Yeah, I had a list. And the eel, it was impossible. I caught them, but then trying to grab them with my own bare hands was always a complete disaster because they are, as you say, extremely slippery. They would just slither out of my hands and then shoot off in the grass, more like a snake than a fish out of water. But had I managed to get eels to join my happy pond party, I would have been a little bit horrified because I now know they would have eaten all the other guests because they are voracious predators and they will eat any other creature that they can get their mouths around, including each other.
Which, Lucy explained, was proven rather graphically in a famous 1930s experiment in France.
Yeah, so basically in the 1930s, there were a couple of researchers in Paris who placed 1,000 elvers, which are young eels, they're about 3 inches long, in a tank of water, and they fed them every day. But even so, after a year, of the 1,000 elvers, there were only 71 left.
Because they all got sick and died, or what?
No, they ate each other. Oh. And so the 71 survivors a year later were three times as long as they were before. And then 3 months later, after what a local journalist reported as daily scenes of cannibalism, there was one champion that was left, and it was a female, woohoo, measuring a foot in length. And she lived 4 more years on her own and could have lived a lot longer if the Nazis hadn't invaded Paris and inadvertently cut off her supply of worms. And she died.
So
those Nazis have got a lot to answer for. The eel story's got it all.
It has everything.
It's got it all. It's even got it's got Freud. It's got Nazis. It's got an international gonads championship. It's got everything.
Wait. International Gonads Championship.
Yes, yes, because there has been, and there still is, a very simple question we've been asking about eels, and that is, where do they come from?
That's a question?
Yes. People have been fishing them and eating them and hunting them and studying them, as you're about to find out, forever and ever and ever. For such an important animal, it's remarkable. It has kept the secret of its origins human being.
How can that be true?
It's not for lack of trying.
It's taken a very, very, very long time to try and figure out the mysteries of the eel.
And Lucy says, this question, where do eels come from?
That is something that has tormented men of science since Aristotle. So he thought that eels were spontaneously generated by the action of water on mud, and that the worm casts that we see in sand were actually embryonic eels boiling out of the earth.
Wait a second. So water would slap, 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 slap against seashore rocks or sand or something, and then poof, up would pop an eel?
Yeah, exactly. That was Aristotle's solution. Okay, it wasn't his finest hour.
No.
And then the great Roman naturalist Pliny the Elder, he thought that eels rubbed themselves against rocks and the scrapings came to life.
You mean like it's dandruff? Like your eel dandruff? Like go rub, 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 and boing, I got a baby?
Exactly, yeah. The ideas of where they came from were utterly fanciful. You know, there was one reverend bishop who claimed in the Middle Ages that he'd seen eels being born out of the thatching of his roof. There were others that thought that they came from dewdrops, but only at certain times of year.
Well, what about when you get a microscope? Like, these are the superstars of science. So Van Leeuwenhoek, he looked at them, right? So he could have seen it.
Yeah, so he thought that they gave birth to live young, like mammals do, because he sort of got his microscope out and he looked inside an eel and he thought he saw little baby eels swimming around inside a bigger eel. But actually, what he'd seen were parasitic worms inside a swim bladder. He was wrong.
What about Carl Linnaeus? As long as we're dealing with the great Linnaeus who categorized all life, did he have an eel idea?
Yep, he did. He thought that they gave birth to live young. But the unfortunate thing was that he was actually looking at the wrong creature. It wasn't an eel. It was a very similar looking fish called an eel pout, which is a completely unrelated type of fish. So he was very wide of the mark.
So let me get rid of the clutter of all of these non-Italians. Because in your story, it turns out that Italians are the ones for, I guess because they have eels in their rivers. They just that we've got to figure this out. I noticed that Leonardo in the Last Supper, are the disciples eating eel for their Passover Seder? Is that what's going on there?
I believe so. I think there are eels on the table in the painting of the Last Supper.
Okay.
So, I mean, the Italians, who are very good with food, took a great interest in the riddle of the origins of the eel. And at a time in the 18th century, while Italy at that time was a load of warring states, there was no sort of sense of national identity. And there was a sort of small band of Italian scientists who decided that somehow that they would forge an identity for their nation, not through revolution, but by finding the gonads of the eel.
Mm.
It's a novel approach to politics.
Yes. Did they succeed in Italianizing the gonad? Like, did they find them in Italian eels?
Well, they made a lot of attempts, basically. Uh-huh. So it started in 1707 when a local surgeon found an unusually plump eel amongst the many thousands that were caught every day on the Po River Delta. And he sliced it open and he saw what he thought was an ovary and eggs. And he sent this pregnant fish to his friend, the esteemed naturalist Vallisneri, who hastily proclaimed the centuries-long search for the eel's private parts was finally over. And unfortunately, he was wrong. But this then sort of ignited this interest amongst the Italian scientific establishment, who decided it was a matter of extreme importance to find the true ovaries of the eel. And they came up with this plan. They thought, I know what we're going to do. All we have to do is put out there a reward.
Like, if you find the gonads of an eel, you'll get 1,000 ducats.
Exactly.
Ah.
So what happened was they got an eel stuffed with eggs, but unfortunately the wily fisherman had filled his eel with the eggs from another fish.
Oh, he cheated. He put
yeah,
it in
he cheated. Oh. So there was a bit of a blow for the Italians' gonad hunt, and it went on pause for about 50 years. And then in 1777, a fresh, fat, slimy suspect flopped up on the shores of Camaccio. And it was examined by the great anatomist Carlo Mondini, who was a professor at the nearby University of Bologna. And he realised that the frilled ribbons inside the eel's abdomen weren't fringes of fatty tissue, which is what they'd previously thought, but they were the female eel's evasive ovaries. So, bingo, ovaries found.
Wait, frilled, what exactly did the ovaries look like?
So, like, if you think of seaweed, mm-hmm. when you open up a female eel, there is a little place in the middle of her tummy that looks like little wispy bits of flesh with little dots on the end.
Oh, they look like seaweed.
Yeah.
That's the ovaries?
Yeah. It turns out that are their ovaries.
How'd they miss that?
I don't know. I think they don't look like anything like mammalian ovaries. They don't look like other fish ovaries. So they were hiding in plain sight.
And so then the male ovaries, do you have any sense of what those?
The male testes are called.
Testes, sorry. Yeah, male testes.
Testicles still missing, though. And what's amazing about the eel story, which is just absolutely extraordinary, is we now have another character who turns up. The mission to complete the eel's genital jigsaw, you might say, fell to an unlikely character, Sigmund Freud.
He's an eel hunter?
Well, he was a student at the time at the University of Vienna, and it was his first ever academic job. He spent a summer trying to track down the testicles of the eel. He was investigating the claim of a Polish professor who had claimed that he had discovered the testicles of the eel, but he hadn't saved them, or he hadn't used a microscope, or for some reason there was no proof. So Freud was given the task of proving this claim. So for weeks, every day, from 8 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, in a hot, smelly laboratory, he sliced open long phallocentric fish in search of their testicles. Freud was completely consumed by it and failed. He couldn't substantiate this Polish professor's claims, and he moved on to look for the seat of desire in another animal, namely the human.
So Lucy says, now jump ahead about 30 years to around the 1890s.
A male eel finally exposed itself, and it was to this chap Giovanni Grassi.
An Italian biologist who one day
found an eel swimming off the coast of Italy.
Scooped it up, brought it back to his lab, cut it open, and saw, finally, and with certainty, this is a little cloudy, how he knew this, but he said, yep, these are the right thing. This is the testes, and those are the sperm.
Nothing short of miraculous.
So did he get a big, a prize, a reward?
Well, I like to think that there was an enormous, great big cup shaped like a pair of testicles.
Okay, let's just keep that thought in our heads and move on.
Yeah, exactly.
But okay, so testes located... Ovaries located.
Right.
Two great mysteries of nature.
But there's another
solved.
One. There's another even bigger one.
Mm.
Where do they go to do this thing? Where the testes and the eggs go whoosh, whoosh, and make a baby.
What do you mean where? Like in the water?
In the water, yes.
But
where on Earth?
Huh.
On Earth, Jad. That turns out to be...
Wow!
An even deeper mystery. That's after the break.
Hi, this is Megan, and I'm calling from cloudy Ithaca, New York. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Radiolab. Okay, so Robert, you left us with the eel mysteries 1 and 2 solved.
Testes, we know where their
located,
sex parts are. Yep.
Ovaries located.
Right. Now you want to know how they have sex and where they have sex.
It's funny. Now that you ask the question, I do want to know the answer, but I wasn't.
Well, this has proven to be, Chad, a very hard question. And it was only a while ago that we found a clue.
Grassi was on a bit of a roll, so he'd found the testicles of the eel.
And the clue was found by our Italian scholar, Grassi.
He does something incredibly ingenious, because as early as the 1850s, there were these tiny, weeny, transparent fish, the shape and thickness of a willow leaf, with bulbous black eyes and these snaggly, gruesome buck teeth, had been documented washing up in huge numbers on the shores of Italy. And these sort of minuscule monsters were just sort of dismissed as just another one of the many, many millions of nondescript marine creatures that inhabit the sea. But Grassi, he thought to himself, I think that those are actually, they're not an adult fish. They're a larvae of a fish.
So they're a baby. I just don't know what they're about to grow up and to become.
Yeah. And what he did that was so incredibly clever was that he counted their vertebrae.
Huh.
And it averaged at about 115. And then he looked for a match in an adult species of fish. And he found it in the European freshwater eel. It's just an amazing piece of biological detective work, I think.
And it revealed that baby eels were living along the coastlines and then washing into the mouths of rivers all over the world, Italy and Spain and Japan and...
And where are we right now?
The great state of New York.
We are on the Fallkill Creek in Poughkeepsie, New York, where this creek enters the Hudson River.
We have eels right around here in New York City.
We do,
in Poughkeepsie.
About 75 miles north of New York City.
So our producer, Becca Bressler, and I went up to Poughkeepsie to meet this man,
right,
Chris Bowser.
I am the Hudson River Estuary Educator for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation.
And Chris explained to us when these tiny little baby eels,
like little pieces of transparent linguine,
arrive in the Hudson River.
They're only about 2 inches long, and they arrive here by the hundreds of thousands. And then they quickly, when they get here,
they start transforming.
Going through these physiological changes, it makes puberty look like a kid's birthday party, what these eels go through.
Basically, these little eels settle down at the bottom of the river
and blend in with the river bottoms
and grow
and grow
and grow and grow and grow and grow and grow and grow.
There's only one way to see how big the eels in there are, and that's to go in there and see them. We want to catch you some adult eels.
Happy to do it.
Or...
not exactly happy to do it. I'm just kind of...
if you'd rather just get the eels, our team can go ahead and get them right now.
No. I'm not going to wuss out on this. I'm
going
to do this.
Keep going then.
Okay.
Just keep going.
But let me ask you, like the first time you actually touched one with your own hands, like, what... tell me what it felt like.
Silky love. People think of eels as being slimy. No, they're satiny, silky. They just feel like these beautiful, muscular, well-adapted miracles of evolution. You cannot touch an eel or hold an eel in your hand without feeling some weird love and wisdom coming to pass.
Any brothers and sisters?
I do. They think I'm strange.
Okay, so how am I going to catch anything with these rubber gloves?
Ah, here comes Aiden to show you how.
Chris and a few of his colleagues and Becca and I, we put on these canvas overalls, rubber boots, rubber gloves.
So this is for you.
And we were given nets.
Oh.
This is what we're going to be using to catch the eels.
Okay.
Scoop them with that net.
Okay. And one of these researchers, she was netless. Instead, she had this long metal rod that connected to a backpack.
I'm going to turn the backpack on. Whenever the backpack is on, it's putting electricity in the water. So
basically, electrical current comes out of the backpack into the metal rod, into the water.
To gently stun and coax these eels out of their hiding places.
And once that happens, that's my cue to grab one.
All right, so is everybody ready?
Ready.
Yes.
All right. Watch them?
Yeah. Sarah Mount, you're in charge. Sarah Mount's giving directions now.
And so we walked out deeper into the creek.
Right.
Okay, we're now mid-creek.
We're going to go nice and slow in the creek.
And eventually, we stopped, and Sarah, the researcher with the backpack...
all right, backpack on.
...sent some electricity into the water, and...
there's an eel.
Up they came.
There's one right there. Yeah, there you go.
One after another.
There's an eel over there.
These long,
and another eel.
Shiny creatures slithering through the water.
Over there. Yeah, two eels in here.
Some of them are over 3 feet long.
This is the biggest.
So,
oh, it's another one.
I tried to net one.
Oh, that wasn't
there's
a small
good,
one.
There's a good eel.
Whoa, almost
let's
I hit it.
Look at it. There's one. Over there, going under the log.
No.
Wait, before you do that, everybody look up here and smile, just because it's a great picture. Go get him!
Everybody ready?
Ready.
Backpack on.
There's an eel.
But I just kept missing and missing.
But I didn't catch any.
And missing until finally.
Come on.
Yay! You got it!
Whoa.
In my net, a 2-foot-long, shiny eel.
If you want to take your glove off and touch it with your bare hand, you're welcome
yes,
to.
Yes, I would love to.
You can feel that silky... smooth
that's
animal.
Silky love coming my way. If I can get off my rubbery glove for the silky
eel's
love.
Not going anywhere.
Okay, Mr. Eel.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, it is kind of. It is kind of silky. Yeah. Oh, it isn't so bad at all.
Yeah.
What do you think, little fella?
Do you feel in danger?
No.
Yeah.
I'm going to call her Florence.
Florence the eel.
Florence the eel. Hey, is your tail?
I should say that eels can survive out of water, even crawl through the grass for hours, but eventually I did let Florence go back into the water, only to learn from Chris and his team that Florence wasn't actually a Florence, that Florence in fact wasn't either a male or a female, because this particular eel didn't have ovaries or testes, and in fact, most of the eels that we saw on that day in the river didn't have ovaries or testes and were all sexless. Because this is the thing that happens the world over. It's that when eels are in rivers, they hang out, they grow, they get bigger, and then they are waiting essentially for this moment that comes almost at the midnight hour of their lives. It's like the ringing of a bell. When just as they're about to get their long-awaited ovaries and testes, they come up from the bottom of the riverbed, and then they make their way down the river and back out into the sea, and then they just disappear. You can't find them.
You mean they just disappear? They can't follow them?
They cannot be followed.
Oh, is that why it was so hard for them to find the sex parts? Because maybe
they had to find an older one, yeah. They didn't have them yet. Yeah. So they're not.
Oh, that explains a lot of it, yeah.
So they're like the opposite of salmon. Salmon start in the rivers and go down to the sea, spend a long time in the ocean, and come back up the rivers. The eels are the unsalmon.
Oh, interesting.
So they start in the ocean somewhere. They go up to the rivers. They get big and mature. Then they head back to the ocean somewhere. The question is where?
Oh,
nobody knows. I mean, this is weird. Like,
do they all go to the same place?
Well, you'll find out.
Okay, all right. Well, shall I try and tell the story of Johannes Schmidt very quickly then?
So back to those early days of scientific eel hunting in the late 1800s, nobody had seen an adult eel out in the sea, strange as that may be. But then there's this guy.
Oceanographer Johannes Schmidt.
Who thought, well, wait a second. The eels we know go out somewhere into the ocean, die, and have babies. We see those babies showing up at the tops of rivers all over the world. So let's track the babies backwards, he thought, starting with the biggest ones, then look for smaller babies, then smaller babies still. And the smallest babies will probably be right at the nest where the parents die and those babies are born.
It's worth noting that Johannes Schmidt was described as being, and I quote, pathologically ambitious.
Because remember, what Schmidt's looking for are these tiny, tiny little eels.
The shape and thickness of a willow leaf.
Like a 3-inch long, translucent piece of wiggly flesh. So small. And we're talking about the Atlantic Ocean. So, like, how are you going to pull this off?
Well, he had, rather fortuitously, he just married the heiress to the Carlsberg Brewery. And they were probably the best lager company in the world for an aspiring oceanographer to hitch his wagon to, because they were known to fund ocean exploration. So he'd married the heiress, and then he was then, because he had all these funds, he was able to spend, after she'd married him, he then disappeared to sea for 20 years.
20 years?
Combing the world's oceans.
From Cairo and Alexandria all the way to Virginia.
With progressively finer nets.
Looking for smaller and smaller and then smaller baby eels.
His breakthrough came in 1921 when he found one that was a quarter of an inch long, which he presumed could be no more than a day or two old.
And Schmidt found this eel
slap bang in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle.
In the Sargasso Sea. First of all, it's so far away from Italy and Spain and Europe. It's kind of near the Carolinas off North America. And it's a very strange place.
It's unusually salty. It's filled with an underwater forest of sargassum seaweed and very, very, very deep. I think in some places it's 4 miles deep.
Oh. It is the only sea, the only thing we call a sea that doesn't have land around it. It's this zone of very quiet water surrounded by roaring currents going in a big circle around it.
And the idea is this is the place where all eels come to have their babies?
No, not all eels, because there's eels all over the world. But for the Atlantic eel, the Sargasso is the place. At least that's the theory. Because since Schmidt's big discovery in 1921, we have been trying to confirm it. So, for instance, a few years ago, scientists in Europe tagged 400 eels to see where they would go. They went into the Mediterranean, but most of them died, and very few got out into the Atlantic, and, you know, a few of them went kind of wandering toward Africa. Then, a year ago, roughly, there was another story about a single tagged eel.
Can you tell me the story of that eel?
I sure can.
It was an eel that started up in the St. Lawrence River in Canada, who would eventually become a female eel.
She heads south, sniffs around. According to the tag, she then heads due east.
Heads first towards Scotland, then reverses away back to Maine.
And starts up quick, beeline south. I don't mean south-ish. I mean south. South like she is following one of the magnetic longitudes of the planet. She heads down, and somewhere at the edge of the Sargasso Sea, the tag comes off. We don't know if it falls off. We don't know if it was eaten. We don't know what happens. All we know is that's the end of the road of the tag, but the fate of that female eel, we don't know.
Exactly. And we don't know, because even today, I mean, in fact, I got an email yesterday from perhaps the world's leading eel scientist, and he explained to me that sadly, after many, many, many years, much effort and millions of dollars spent, still no one had managed to actually track an eel all the way from the rivers of Europe the Sargasso.
But they tried, right?
They did, exactly. They sunk swollen eel temptresses into the Sargasso, hoping that they would attract males and they could catch them in flagrante and then finally prove that definitely that was observed eels mating, but still it's never been seen. It's never been witnessed.
Maybe the guys aren't there. Maybe they've got the wrong place. Or maybe the guys are shy, or maybe the guys know a science experiment when they see one and are just not going to tell. I don't know which of those three.
Or they are actually breeding on the moon and falling out of the sky, raining on the Sargasso. We can't rule that out.
We don't know where exactly. We don't know how exactly. But somewhere in the Sargasso Sea, there's the miracle of a fertilized eel egg.
Miracle because no one's ever seen it?
Correct.
Ever. In the wild.
There is a secret sauce with eels that we have not solved. Forget the Coca-Cola recipe. Eel sex is the real mystery of our generation. And we think we know roughly where in the Sargasso Sea it happens, but that's a think, not a know. We have never witnessed in the wild eel egg fertilization.
Well, I know you're not an eel. So let me ask you, like, have you imagined where all the... Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that there is a place that Atlantic eels go to, and it is a place where they have sex, and it's a place where they have babies, and it's a place where they die. In your imagination, what does that place look like, speaking as a human?
In my imagination... And make sure that line makes it in. In my imagination, and again, this is without any proof... But in my imagination, I like to think of some deeper waters of the Sargasso Sea, somewhere between Bermuda and Puerto Rico. It's a quiet place. It's a dark place. It's beyond the reach of all but the barest of wavelengths of light up top. And I think that with these eels, you know, I've often wondered, do they pair off discreetly? Is there sort of a massive orgy of eels that happen? And I like to think of eels as once they get there, there's got to be some sort of primitive, ichthyological celebration. That feeling of, my gosh, I have finally accomplished a 30-year, 3,000-mile journey. All of us have. But I'm going to go back to what we were talking about, how much I love the mystery. I don't like to overthink it.
Oh, you don't want to even think about it.
I don't want to overthink it because, again, I almost respect and love the mystery so much that I see, like in the eel movie, right? Fade to black. Cue the music, the fireside lighting, you know, slow dissolve, fade to black. Ta-da.
This piece was produced by Becca Bressler and Matt Kielty. Special thanks to the men and women of the Hudson River Estuary Program who helped us with this project and brought their equipment and their bodies and their strange clothing down to the creek, and to Clay Hiles of the Hudson River Foundation who set us up with these folks, and to Kim Airstrup.
And to all the eels that are on the cusp of that great journey into the unknown.
Who still won't tell us what
they
know.
Deep water nursery.
Yeah. Thank you, eels.
Of mystery.
Yes.
Keep doing it, eels. Keep doing it.
And they're doing it, by the way, right around now. So it's in hurricane season. So for a variety of reasons, these animals are just not telling.
Well, we are not done yet. Luckily for all of us, we have one more mystery of the animal kingdom. It's actually sort of a two-parter. But it deals with one creature, another creature, not eels, but a different one, tiny little sea creature that is so beautifully, insanely weird and wild and loud, you're going to want to hear it. So I would urge you to stay tuned because that new animal mystery is coming up after the break. Radiolab will continue in a moment.
Hi, this is Barbie calling from Portland, Oregon. Radio Lab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radio Lab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled babbel.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. Today, we have a mystery that is
vanishingly tiny,
shockingly hot,
and manages to combine submarines,
Keanu Reeves,
Red Lobster,
and Game of Thrones.
And of course, our producer, Molly Webster, and many members of her family.
Hello, 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 hello. Where are the children?
So you want to begin in the beautiful state of South Carolina?
South Carolina.
It's on a pier.
Yeah. Is my radio gear waterproof?
Yes.
No. On a dock? Oh, okay, so we're going to walk down to the docky, which is just like this place where they all put boats in the water.
I'm Oliver!
And that's where we always...
Chicka-laka-laka-boom-boom!
Shut up! I'm going to explain what a dock is! Okay. My parents recently moved to this marshy, swampy area near the Intracoastal Waterway, which is like a connecting series of salty channels. And we grew up in Ohio, and so this is like a totally different landscape than what we grew up in.
Okay.
And those little people would be my nieces and nephews.
I'm riding my bike so we can ride it back.
Do you hear that, America? Those are my children getting along and compromising. That would be Chrissy Webster, one of my sisters. Yeah, we sound a lot alike. Anyway. So this is the story. The story is, when my parents first moved there, I remember going out on the docks with my dad, and we were sort of looking at the beautiful marsh, right? And there was this really weird sound, like, coming off the water. I recently took my nieces and nephew out to see if they could hear it. Okay, we're going to be...
I'm in position.
Okay, so we're not going to move, and we're not going to squeak.
Not gonna talk.
We're not gonna talk.
Okay.
So we lean down off the dock.
Okay, ready?
Now we're gonna see if we can hear it. Oh my gosh, I hear some crackles.
That crackling sound?
Yeah.
What is that?
That was the question.
Sounds like Rice Krispies. Yeah.
Most of the scientists you talk to say it sounds like bacon frying or twigs crackling in a fire.
Maybe you have a large Perrier factory just up the hall.
Yeah, I would say that, except there's no bubbles popping like on the water.
Oh, so it's not a gaseous emission. It's a clickety-clack.
Let me just play you a better recording.
Yeah, pull it up.
Wait, do I have to put it through the producer PC?
Wait, here we go.
This is actually an underwater recording.
Oh, my God. Oh. Gosh, in a teeny world, that would be like the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's big.
It's bigger than bacon.
It's bigger than bacon.
Bigger than bacon.
I don't know. It depends on how much bacon you're frying.
So, all right, what is this sound? What is it?
This sound is a very tiny...
No, wait.
Let me just back it up a second.
Well, the story started in the 40s.
That's Michel Verslaus.
Professor of physical acoustics and medical acoustics at the University of Twente in the Netherlands.
Basically what he said is World War II is the first war where we're like really using submarines and sonar. And so you've got all of these U.S. Navy submarines down deep in the ocean and they're like listening out for the enemy.
But what happens is all they hear is this like crazy crackling sound.
The sound levels that were measured, so this sound is very, very intense.
He says in some instances it was actually interfering with the sonar.
And that was a bit of a problem.
Yeah, so I found a classified document that was declassified right after the war, where the Navy, they actually hired this scientist, this guy named Martin Johnson. This is in California.
I believe it was in San Diego at Scripps.
They hired this guy to figure out, what the is the sound? Like, what is the sound we're hearing, like, all over the ocean?
What is it already?
Chad's like, just tell me what the damn sound is.
Yes!
Well, it turns out, I don't want to go too fast here.
It was noted in those years that sound originated from...
The shrimpy's trumpet.
It was a shrimp.
Oh, yeah.
The shrimp is called a snapping shrimp or a pistol shrimp.
Ooh. Pistol shrimp.
I like that.
Yeah.
Pistol.
And interestingly, I found these like old Navy recordings that they would give to the Navy guys where they had to learn the sounds they were hearing coming in through the ship and through the sonar.
In your work with the expendable radio sonobuoy, you will probably hear many sounds other than submarine sounds.
It was like, this is the sound of a
snapping shrimp. It produces a harsh clicking noise.
And I was like, okay, shrimp, sonar, cool. I get it. Thought maybe it would end there. And then I found what felt to me to be a crazy article, which was this newspaper clipping from 1946. Basically says, shrimps helped win the war.
What?
And I was like, what? And it's about how the American Navy admitted that one of their tactical things during, like, World War II was that they would hide their submarines in the beds of these shrimp so, like, the Japanese submarines couldn't detect our ships.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was like a marine invisibility cloak.
Yes. And according to Michelle, the U.S. would also...
put speakers on the hull of the ships to simulate... snapping shrimp.
Wait, what?
It was sound camo.
Yeah.
So wait. Are these shrimp, are they like normal shrimp cocktail type shrimp?
Well.
They're about 5 centimeters, 2 inches.
So like smaller than a shrimp I might eat.
Well, it depends what sort of shrimp you eat.
Well, I don't know, whatever. Red lobsters there. No, I don't know.
Wait a second. If they're that small, how are they making that sound?
That is an excellent question. Wait, where do you think the sound comes from?
I'm thinking it's the shrimpies are eating their food, and the noise is their little teeth.
Ooh, shrimpy teeth.
I think it comes from their like snappy claw thingies.
And that's what you would think, right? Like, especially if you look at these things up close.
They have 2 front claws and the claws aren't the same on each side.
That's Nancy Knowlton, a marine biologist, snapping shrimp expert.
There's a claw that's specialized for pinching.
And that claw is tiny.
And a claw that's specialized for snapping.
And that claw is like exponentially bigger. It's like 10 times, 20, maybe 3 times bigger.
It's quite a bit bigger. And so they use it to defend themselves against potential predators or competitors. And they're very territorial.
She says when one shrimp runs into another shrimp,
they can get into these prolonged snapping matches where they snap at each other to show
me,
who's bigger and who's stronger.
Me. Okay, fine.
And they can pretty much judge how big they are by the power of the snap.
All of which is to say, my niece Sophie's guess.
I think it comes from... they're like snappy claw thingies.
Is like, yeah, of course. It's like the 2 sides of the claw just like snapping together.
It's just like you snap your fingers like this.
Just a snap.
Snap.
But that turns out not to be true.
So not true.
2 things were wrong basically with that picture. So I don't know if you have ever tried to clap your hands in the swimming pool underwater, but yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah, you don't feel very smart when you try. It doesn't work.
But there's not a lot of sound, and that is because there's a lubrication layer of water in between that prevents a direct mechanical contact.
Yes, there's this lubricating layer between the 2 claw halves, and it makes snapping hard.
And the second problem was that...
the sound just seemed way too loud. Like when they measured the decibel level of a single snap...
it's about... 220 decibels of sound that can be produced by a single snap.
To put that in context, that is basically equivalent to... a jet plane from just one snap.
But it's very impulsive, so it's in a very, very short duration.
But still, it's like one of the loudest sounds in the ocean. So Michelle was like, there's probably more than snapping going on here.
Yeah, so
okay, so it was 1999.
We had the new high-speed camera in our lab.
And so they're like, okay, we're going to point this camera at the shrimp.
And see what happens when this shrimp snaps its claw.
So they take the little shrimps and they glue screws on their butts.
They glue screws on their butts.
Yeah, and they screw them into tiny platforms in like little aquariums.
So that they were fixed in space. And that was important.
Because it happens in like a microsecond and they need to keep it still so the camera can just focus right on the claw.
And to do the experiment, what we needed to do was to tickle them a little bit with the paintbrush.
Okay. You tickled them with the paintbrush?
Yeah, exactly. Then they cocked their claws. And then they
snap, and then it fires, and the camera captures the entire thing with like thousands of frames per second.
And did they see anything?
They did see something.
What
is it?
When they looked at the footage of the moment just after it snaps in super slow-mo,
we saw a very blurry object in front of the shrimp.
What blurry? It was just like bloppy, blurry something.
It was bloppy, blurry. I mean, it turned out that we were sort of out of focus.
So they refocus the camera. They do the same thing. They tickle the shrimp. The claw snaps. And they see that when the claw snaps, they see this like bubble in front of the shrimp claw. And it turns out that it's that bubble that's causing the noise and so much undersea turmoil. The bubble is at the root of everything.
Okay.
And with the high-speed camera, they were sort of able to see how it all breaks down. And it sort of unfolds like this.
What actually happens when this claw closes is that the water that is in between these claws is squeezed out at high speed. The typical speed can be up to 60 miles per hour.
Like as fast as a car goes?
Oh, yes, yes.
So this jet of water shoots out like 60 miles per hour. And what happens is like behind the jet is that this like empty space is created. Like a little void in the ocean. And all the water molecules in that space, because they're like, ooh, look at all this room. They start to expand outwards. And essentially, they just become like a little gas bubble.
They actually change from liquid to gas?
Yeah, they actually go from like liquid is like tightly packed molecules. And then as they spread out, they become like gaseous. And they create this like little gas bubble pocket in the middle of the huge ocean. And as they have all the space, they like get bigger and bigger and bigger until the ocean's like, nope. Microseconds later, the ocean starts pushing back in on this bubble, and all the little air molecules in this bubble have nowhere to go, and they're getting forced closer and closer together. And so they really want to get away from each other, all those air molecules. But you're pushing them together really hard, and since they can't get away from each other, like the energy builds up super, super huge,
and the pressure rises, and the temperature rises.
Really rises.
5,000 degrees. The surface of the sun is also 5,000 degrees.
And the gas that's inside the bubble turns to plasma.
And that plasma emits a very short, intense flash of light.
And then the bubble implodes.
And then,
like a microsecond later,
it generates the shockwave. And that shockwave will basically kill or stun any prey that is nearby.
Somebody from the College of Exaggeration graduated this particular explanation. Because you've got this teeny little animal with an enormous bubble as hot as the sun. And then I think, oh, yeah, okay.
It's fairly crazy, yes. But it's amazing how evolution has created this kind of sonic weapon.
So basically,
yes.
Shrimps, they're like super awesome because they have this claw that generates huge bubbles of heat. And it's like, go mess with a shrimp because it's a black belt.
Wow, so it's spitting out light and hot, hot, hot temperatures.
Yeah.
Does that mean that, God,
I know, the sun thing is crazy.
That's crazy.
I feel like it should be like a Marvel character.
Totally. Yeah, because if you scaled this up, the bubble would be the size of a basketball in human scale.
Mm-hmm.
What could I do with a basketball of sun, heat, and light? I could rule the world with that.
Could you imagine?
I'll be having that cab. Hey, that last piece of cake is mine.
That was what, when my sister was hanging off the dock, she asked, like, can we use this to power, like, the world or something? No, the answer was no. But the same physical processes that are involved in the shrimp bubbles, right? So like the temperature and the heat that bubbles can create, researchers became really excited about. Is there a way to harness this bubble power?
Yeah, there's also a Hollywood movie.
I think I did it.
Is it stable?
On powerful bubbles with Keanu Reeves, I believe.
Really? Really?
Yes, yes.
There is enough energy in this glass of water to power the city of Chicago for weeks.
They went too far.
Boom!
Like, boom!
Taken with the weapon possibilities.
Yeah, my nephew got excited about this, too.
My name's Oliver. Ha.
But I hate to tell you, but I don't think there are any.
You mean you can't, like, make a bigger claw? Put it on a sub?
No.
Sorry, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is this one thing where researchers are thinking about using bubbles, and this goes beyond the shrimp bubbles, in a way that could save lives. So when I was talking to Michelle Versluis,
applications.
We're talking on the phone and he explains all the crazy bubbly stuff. And somehow, like in the middle of the conversation, he just said, if you think the shrimp bubbles are cool, everything we know about the shrimp bubbles, like, can also be like adapted to use bubbles in the body.
Oh.
And I was just like, what?
wait, but bubbles in the body, isn't that
an embolism though?
Like, yeah,
totally. I had the same thought. Like when divers get the bends or when they like tap bubbles out of IV lines and stuff.
But these are very, very small bubbles, smaller than red blood cells.
According to Versluis, they're like 1/20th the size of human hair.
And they are completely harmless.
And he told me about how in Toronto, and they actually just did this for the first time in November on a patient, they're using bubbles to get across the blood-brain barrier.
Huh. What exactly is the blood-brain barrier? Is it cells or is it tissue?
Yeah, it's super, super tightly packed cells. It sort of sits between the bloodstream and the brain. It's like this protective wall, and it keeps out all of like the nasty stuff. So it keeps out any like bacteria or viruses that would be in your bloodstream, can't get past the wall to get into your brain. I kind of keep thinking of it as like, I've never actually watched Game of Thrones except for like one episode, and in it there was this giant wall.
Yeah.
To protect civilization from sort of all the bad things, the wild things. And it was made of ice and it went up forever.
I've never fallen before!
I kind of feel like that wall in Game of Thrones is like the barrier between the rest of the body and the brain.
But you said it's there to protect the brain, so why would you want to punch a hole in it?
Well, you can imagine that if somebody has a brain tumor and we want to deliver chemicals in there that we think can help fight the tumor, those chemicals the brain does not want in there.
So the blood-brain barrier can create problems, according to Todd Mainprise.
I'm a neurosurgeon at Sunnybrook.
He's part of the team in Toronto that's using this new bubble technique, and here's how it works. Okay, so say you've got a tumor on the right side of your brain, right above your ear. So Mainprise and his team will stick you in a chair, and then they'll put a helmet on you.
Special helmet. This helmet has 1,024 ultrasound transducers. And we aim the 1,024 all to the same spot.
Right on the spot at the wall where the tumor sits, just on the other side, just out of reach.
Okay, so that all the ultrasound waves kind of focus at that one area. And then we inject the bubbles.
How many bubbles are in a dose?
Like hundreds of thousands. So they just put an IV in your arm and the bubbles go in. And they'll go like into your arm, like over your shoulder, into your heart, to your lungs, back to your heart. Eventually, some of them will get up to the brain.
We know it takes approximately 28 seconds from the time we inject the bubble into her arm vein to by the time they start going into her brain.
And eventually, some of those bubbles get up to the blood-brain barrier, that wall, to the spot where that laser beam is focused, that specific spot that the tumor is sitting on the other side of. And when they cross paths with that beam,
the ultrasound waves causes the microbubbles to oscillate in size.
They'll go big and small, big and small.
Big, small, big, small, big, small, big, small.
Oscillate in size.
I think of it as like a bubble dance party. So at this really specific part in the brain, and it can be smaller than like 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter squared, all these bubbles are dancing. And what that does is it causes the wall, that specific spot, to almost loosen. And so like a little like window of space or a little hole is created in that wall. And if you happen to have chemotherapy in your blood, which you will because we'll give it to you ahead of time, the minute that hole is open, the idea is the chemotherapy in your bloodstream would be able to just sort of flow through that opening and get straight to that brain tumor tissue.
So they're using sound to turn the bubbles into little dancing drill bits.
Yeah.
And drill through the wall.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, the body's a living organism. So over the next 6 to 12 hours, it will close those gaps. It's transient, meaning it heals itself in about 6 to 12 hours.
And you're saying they tried this on someone already?
Yeah, last November. And they think it went well. One of the things these researchers said was once you're able to open these passageways to the brain, it's not just chemo that can get in there, but like suddenly any type of drug you might want to send through can get through. And we've just never had access to the brain before in that way. And there's this question of like, how will drugs interact with the brain? We kind of don't know. They've never been there before. It's like a whole new frontier. You think shrimping time is done?
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically all boils down to the same sort of physics of bubbles that we have learned from this shrimp and that we can apply to many other applications.
Fun! It's dinner time!
We're going to put it on the radio so you'll hear it, the people that like shrimp.
What if people don't like shrimp?
Then they'll just skip it.
I can't believe Molly's putting this on the radio.
Oh, I make no promises that this is going on the radio.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Molly Webster. This piece was produced by Molly and Annie McEwen.
With help from our guest sound designer, Jeremy Bloom. Special thanks to Kulir Vohinenen, James Bird,
Lawrence Crum,
and Elliot Sophie Oliver and Chrissy, all of them Websters.
My name is Joseph Backer, and I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Message one.
This is Chrissy Webster,
Elliot Oliver,
and Sophie by proxy. She's at her friend's house. But we are reading the credits. Radio Lab is produced by
Chad of Room Red.
Dylan Keith is our
director of sound design.
Doran Wheeler is
the senior editor. Jamie York is our senior producer.
Our staff includes Simon Adler, Brenna Farrell, David Gebel, Matt Kelty, Robert Krolwich, Kenny McEwen, Kenny Mill, Latif Nasir, Melissa O'Connell, Kelsey Paget, Gary Ann Wack,
and Molly Webster.
Molly Webster.
With help from
Alexander Lee Young, Stephanie Taylor, Micah Lowinger. Our fact checkers are Eva Dasher and Michelle Harris. And we're serious about science.
End of message.